Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan, our sub-series, Short Takes, where me, JJ Walsh, here in Hiroshima, Japan, is joined by...
Hi, I'm Tova Kinoka in Yokohama.
And we do a kind of conversation every month for 30 minutes where we talk about things that have been on our radar. We're both working in sustainability in different parts of Japan. It's always a great conversation. Thanks again for joining, Tova.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And of course, if you're joining us live, please write your comments and questions below. Tova, I had a chance last week to go to a press tour for Sustainable Kobe.
Ah, okay. I think and I saw your post on this. It looks super
interesting. Yeah, it was really, really interesting. So I couldn't join the first day, but I had joined their Sustainable Kobe event in Tokyo last year, which was talking about how they're harvesting from sewage, they're harvesting phosphorus and using it in agriculture. And that was really interesting. So I wasn't able to see that how they're doing it with farms. But the second day started with a discussion with local officials about how they're reusing akiya, which are abandoned properties, a big problem all over Japan, and really exciting to hear about their strategies and what things they're trying to put into effect. And then later in the day, we were able to visit one of the reused buildings. Actually, two of the buildings, three of the buildings. One of them was a reused school, and they're using it as kind of a community center. This was a school that's no longer used. And then inside, like you've been to Kamikatsu, the zero waste town, inside they had like a kuru-kuru kind of free cycle area where people could pick up things they needed, drop off things they needed. Unfortunately, there was a bit of plastic recycling theater, which I think we still see in Japan, right? That idea that if you clean everything and you separate everything, that it's going to actually be recycled, where we know, in fact, even in Kobe, all over Japan, less than 20% is actually recycled. And if you do recycle it into something like a plastic pallet, which they were talking about, that can only be recycled one time. Right?
Yeah.
So this focus, all this energy on plastic recycling, I think is a little bit outdated. So that was a little bit disappointing, but all the rest of the tour was fantastic. So, you know, unfortunately, I didn't get to talk much with the officials about that. But that's something we need to be a bit more honest about, don't you think?
I think so. And I think anyone who still thinks that is the answer needs to go to Netflix and watch the documentary, The Plastic Detox, which has come out very recently and is a massive eye-opener, I think, as to and really, really hits home as to why we need to be reducing our dependency on plastic, not just sort of recycling it, but all the chemicals that are used in the processing and in the plastic itself. It's not just about the item, but it's all the chemicals that go into it and how, you know, that's getting into the microplastics, the nanoplastics that we can't see, but they're building up in our environment, in our bodies, and the impact that's having. So go and watch that documentary if you haven't yet. It is shocking, and it will make you look at your home and all the things you're using in a very new light.
Yeah. And it's definitely not something that it's forward thinking, right? It's kind of 10 years ago, all these bins where it's so meticulously labeled and so meticulously separated. But in the end, you can only recycle it meaningfully one time. And burning plastic garbage is not recycling. We need to stop saying that too, right? But the rest of it was fantastic. So they also had, you know, the fry to fly project. So collecting used cooking oil, using it for sustainable aviation fuel. That was cool to see that they were doing. They did have one section where they were giving out free coffee and they said, please use the water from the dispenser. And I was like, oh, are you encouraging people to reuse their own water bottles? Oh, no, you're not allowed to do that. You have to use a paper cup. So there's a few little tweaks I would recommend doing. But then, yeah, you know, it's overall, it's a discussion. It's like one of the other press on the tour said, oh, isn't it, you know, it's not great, is it? And I said, you know what? The fact that they're doing something is already a win. The fact that they're gathering the community, trying to talk about solutions and strategies is amazing and better than the status quo, better than the norm.
Exactly. And it's through doing things like this so that then we can have those conversations about, you know, how can we make this better? And if they get feedback from people like you and that other visitor as well, then they can understand how they can improve it. But if those conversations not happening in the first place, then that opportunity is not there, right?
Absolutely. And then we went to a reused recycling facility called Bibak. And it is a really cool idea where they're reusing this old recycling center building, which was disused. And it's very cool. And it's right next to the incinerator. So people are already using that area to deal with garbage. Mm-hmm. But what they're doing is showing how parts of traditional Japanese houses have value and can be reused and remade into other things. And so it's, you know, it's connected to like the Minka Summit, which is coming up next month, right? The idea that old traditional houses and old traditional Japanese culture, these handcrafted pieces, which are all parts of old houses, they do have so much value. And it's not like in Portland or in Hawaii where they actually are reselling the parts that they're salvaging, but it's more like a research center where they're thinking of new ways to reinvent use of these parts, which is also very cool. So they did have like a old beams from the houses, which are so beautiful, wonderful wood, handcrafted, rethinking it as maybe table legs. They had beautiful wood that was aged over time, redesign it as part of a wall. So many things they had reminded me of Kamikatsu when you visit Horizon One Brewery, the Hotel Y. They had one wall where they put lots of old doors and windows together and it made a beautiful collage that would be a really nice feature for a restaurant or a cafe, right?
Exactly,
so it's just like having these discussions, having people enthusiastic about it was really wonderful to see.
That's great. That's really good to see. It just makes me so sad when you see buildings being pulled down and all of the stuff getting crushed and going into a skip when you know it could be used again. So that's really good to see.
Absolutely. Here's that wall of reused doors and windows and the traditional glass, which is so beautiful that you can only find in old houses. And then they had one idea where you take the old glass and you can make plates and even light fixtures with the old glass if you just melt it a little bit. And that was really innovative and very creative to see.
That's great to see.
Yeah. And then we went to Shokudo, which is a reuse of an abandoned building. It was abandoned for about 10 years. It's called Spice Up. Marugo is the name of the shotengai. And they had renovated it into a space that is accessible so that not only can customers in wheelchairs use it, but they can get local staff who also use wheelchairs. And it was just fantastic. It seems like such a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But when you're renovating an old place, there's no reason not to make it accessible. And then in our aging communities, if anybody is in a wheelchair, if anybody has walking, you know, difficulties, it opens it to everyone. And then women with babies in strollers can also use it. Like this is something we're just not seeing as much. So it was so inspiring to see it in use.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Now, Tova, you did a lot of events for International Women's Day. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, we've, as we know, March the 8th was International Women's Day, but there are things happening all month. This was an event on Wednesday this week. So run by the British Chamber of Commerce. And you can see there Junko Kubokawa, who's the kind of diversity and inclusion champion for the BCCJ, there, and it was hosted by PwC, and we had the British ambassador there in the centre with the pink jacket come to sort of talk about her career in diplomacy and how things have changed in the diplomatic sphere since she first joined. And she, it was interesting, she said when she first started her career in the diplomatic service, there weren't really any female role models at a senior level, because it had always been the rule, actually, that as soon as a female diplomat got married, she would have to resign her post, because it was assumed that her husband's career would be more important, that she would not be able to therefore travel, and she would have to stay with him and, you know, just sort of be in the house and be the mother, etc. So she said it was really interesting when she came on her first post overseas, and she and her husband were thinking about starting a family, and she sort of was really concerned about going to speak to her boss and saying, look, you know, if I start a family, is it okay to, you know, have my child outside the UK and not have to be sent home? And then that would be the end of her career. Luckily, she had a very supportive boss who said, yes, absolutely, no problem. She was also able in one of her posts to do job share with another woman who was on maternity leave. So that was sort of very forward thinking for its time, I think. And then sort of as she's gone up through the ranks over the years, at almost 40 years now, she's got just a few years left of her career in the diplomatic service. But she said she's seen it change hugely in that time. And I think now she was saying 43% of British ambassadors overseas are women, which is really, really nice to see. And she said they've got this one thing in their headquarters back in London, where they've got the sort of a gallery of female leaders who have been the first, you know, female ambassador to this country, or the first in this particular senior role, and so on. And then the places where they haven't yet had a female leader at that level, they've got the title, the role title, and a mirror above it, so that you can go and stand in front of it, you see yourself in that mirror with the title and go, oh, that's possible, actually.
I love
that. It's a really nice way to kind of say, well, okay, nobody's done it yet, but why couldn't you do it? And showing sort of people that it's not a, that it's not possible. It is there. There are the opportunities if you're sort of prepared to stick your hand up and go for it. So that was really nice hearing her story. And then we broke out into breakout rooms. Six different groups. I was facilitating one of them, and we had somebody facilitating each one. The audience could choose which one they went to. In my room, we were talking about, as more sort of experienced at the older female leaders, what can we do? How can we use our experience and learning, particularly the kind of the unofficial things you've learned, the stuff you don't learn if you go and do a course, for example, all of those other little bits and pieces that actually make a difference. How could we find opportunities to share those, and how can we open doors for other women to come up through as well, and create more opportunities for others? So that was a great little discussion. Other groups were looking at sort of leadership from different perspectives, or organizational culture as well. So it was a really great event, lots of energy, real diverse range of men and women there, which was nice, but all ages as well. So it was great to get lots of different perspectives on the topic.
Oh, that's great. That sounds like a really community supportive event. Mm. And I think as we see Prime Minister Takeuchi now in discussions with the American administration, mm-hmm. it is very obvious how she is the only woman in the room.
Yeah,
she is not supported by other women. And that's on both sides. And so, you know, you feel like her team, or, you know, someone in Japan needs to prep her more to have powerful women by her side who are supporting her. And of course, we need men as allies, but we need women in the room, you know. And so having this wonderful event for International Women's Day, I think really highlights that the UK is not that far behind in getting equal rights for women. America's definitely suffered a lot from the current administration and rolling back a lot of the progress we were making, right? Japan, we have a prime minister who is a woman, but how can we support her as a woman leader a little bit better, right? Yeah. Prepare her to show more of her amazing intelligence. And we know that, you know, she's got a lot of great experience in diplomacy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, before the next meeting, we hope that we can prepare and support with other women.
Yes,
right? It makes a difference.
It really does. And I think just, you know, like we were talking about in our breakout room at the event I was just talking about, you know, giving other women around her the opportunity, then if she's got to that position, wonderful. That means that she's then able to open the door for others. And so it would be good to see that happening.
Yeah, I didn't realize about that until 1973. Women were forced to retire if they had children. I'm often asked by visitors about the big gender gap in Japan. And it's on everyone's radar, especially women who are visiting Japan. And I say, well, one of the big issues is women feel they have to choose parents, parenthood, or career. Like, that's a real serious choice. And most people coming from other countries, they can understand that that dichotomy, that need to choose. But, you know, we do have laws and support in other countries, which we don't yet have in Japan. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely discussion about how can we make regulation, make law that protects working women and gives them more opportunities to choose parenthood and career. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And be more flexible about things like sort of the ambassador was talking about her job share thing. And I know I think one of the other companies that was speaking that day also talked about that. And that's something we haven't seen very much happening. I remember I proposed it, my friend and I proposed it to my previous company years ago, and it was a flat no. Weren't even prepared to consider it. But you think, well, actually, if you've got two people who are prepared to make it work and they're going to do the job, you know, as well, if not better than one person would do it by themselves, then why is that such an issue? So I think there
needs to be. And then also, like when you're talking about new styles of work, like what millennials, what younger workers are hoping for, and how the more younger workers are very comfortable with hybrid type of work experience. So working at home a little bit, working in coffee shops, working at shared offices is not a problem. They have their laptop, they can work from anywhere. And allowing that kind of flexibility of work structure would also very much encourage women to work and balance their home life and their work life if they were given the opportunity to work from home or work from school or work from the hospital if they have to take their parents or kids in to get a checkup or something, right?
Exactly. And also, I think it just gives people, I mean, more flexibility. There's a lot of been a lot of discussion around the rural revitalization, right, and how to encourage people to move away from the cities where everyone's clustered to the rural areas, which are really struggling through population decline and so on. But if work is not flexible, it's very hard to do that. They need to be where the work is, where the schools are, and where, you know, things around them, the infrastructure is there for raising a family. Whereas if we're more flexible about work, and we know, having come through COVID, that, you know, remote work is possible for so many jobs, then that gives an opportunity for people to live in more rural areas, have a nicer pace of life, more space for their families and so on, and still do the work that they were doing. So it would be great to see that sort of job style, but also maybe sort of incentivizing people to move out to those areas, making sure that, you know, the government's investing in the infrastructure there so that there is, you know, the things that families need is there for them. It's possible. It just needs a little more holistic thinking rather than just saying we'll give you a subsidy for having more children. It's like, but, you know, nothing else is changing. So it really doesn't help.
Yeah. And then we look at Scandinavian countries and we see how once they brought in more equality at work and in leadership and governments and they had quotas and they filled them, then they had more women who were willing to have children and careers. Yes. You know, that it all is connected. It's not just funding having a child. It's much more than that. It's about giving women more opportunities at work to make equal pay. Why isn't equal pay more of a conversation, right?
Right. Well, it's only the large companies at the moment that have to disclose gender pay gap statistics. And unfortunately, I mean, sort of, I think it's something like 80% of Japanese companies are small to medium enterprises, but they're not forced to disclose yet because they're under the threshold size. So the inequality there can carry on, you know, unchallenged and unseen, which I think is a problem. I think really any company ought to be disclosing that.
Especially with this low labor, this labor shortage that we're having, it is in companies' favor to be open and honest and develop their brand as an equal pay brand to get great workers who are women as well as men, right?
Yeah, benefits everyone.
We had a great comment from Nori. Thanks for joining, saying sustainable, recyclable materials. Wonderful. Fantastic to have you here. And that brings me to one of my next examples, which I've been seeing more in stores here in Hiroshima. It's available in the Hiroshima station. So it's something I always recommend to people visiting. It's a Japanese traditional bag maker who is also making upcycled rice bags into really cool tote bags. Now, my husband did an interview with the Katoka Shoten, the bag maker, and it's changing from the older generation to the younger generation in the family who's now running the shop, and he's got new ideas, and but still making these high quality bags, a lot of school bags they were making traditionally, and such great old pictures as well. But these reusing the old rice bags is very cool. You can actually carry 30 kilograms of things in it, but they are super, super light paper. So it doesn't, you know, take any effort to be carrying them, but they're super strong and they look cool because they have the design in Japanese of the old rice bag. So I think as we're entering into kind of high season for tourism right now, it's definitely worth thinking about you know, supporting these more sustainable business ideas. And really they are available, you know, these upcycled things. I carry a bag which is an upcycled highway sign and it says Yoru on it. And I always get lots of comments and it's a great discussion. So it's a really cool thing to carry around, but it also creates a great discussion about how to reuse things. And isn't it better to reuse what's already here? I think as we're having this big, you know, Iran war is affecting us for tourism, but also it's affecting gas prices like around the world. And so this idea to reuse things already in Japan, especially if it's wasted, if it's not being used, that's a resource we have at our fingertips, right?
Exactly.
Why not use a little bit of innovation and creativity to sell it, to make use of it, right? It's amazing.
Well, it reminds me of that quote that waste is just a resource in the wrong place, right? And I think it's a perfect example of it. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, I have just ordered a new EV. Now, this is exciting news. It's coming from Honda. It's called the Insight, and it's a fully electric car just launched, and I'll have one next month, and I'll be one of 3,000 owners. They're limiting it, the first launch, to 3,000 cars, and I was an early adopter to another electric car company and had an accident and had to replace it. So I'm really excited to be one of the early adopters for Honda's new all-electric line. And this is a Japanese, really high-quality, family-run, you know, Japanese business that has a great reputation. But they're really struggling because their biggest market right now, the U.S., because of the current administration, they have had a big turnaround. Even though customers are demanding more electric cars, that's the future, is electric cars. People want it. They can charge it themselves at home. They know it's more sustainable, but also a better product.
Yeah.
But it's been a big loss year for Honda because they're going all in. But if you, in your neighborhood too, Tova, do you notice that the post office delivery is done by electric motorbike now?
Yes, actually.
Those and are Hondas.
And not just the motorbikes. There was a small van that came past me a couple of days ago, post office delivery van. I didn't notice whether it was a Honda or not, but
that's a Mitsubishi in our area. They have the little delivery vans or Mitsubishis, but all the bikes are Hondas, and so it's nice. You hear the whirring sound instead of the usual engine sound. But you know, it's exciting. It's going to be a great year for electric vehicles in Japan to see, and Honda is really going for it. So we got to support these local businesses, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well done, Honda.
Yay. Now you had an event coming up, Venture Cafe Nagoya Connect.
Yes. So Venture Cafe originally came from Cambridge in the US, but now they've got sort of branches all over the world, including one in Tokyo that has a Thursday gathering, a meeting every week with startups, VCs, corporates, entrepreneurs, all coming together. To talk about sort of what they're doing. A lot of it is focused on sort of solving sustainability related issues. A lot of green tech and stuff comes through there. And Nagoya Connect is one of the offshoots of that. So it's every other week. And so I'm joining a panel there on next Friday, the 27th of March. My friend Tomomi Komura is moderating it, and I'll be there with Motoharu Kuroi, who is the CEO of Neuromagic Japan, which is a really interesting company. Go and have a look if you haven't heard of them. They're doing lots of different things, but one of those things is sustainability strategy. And Dr. Sam Sinclair, who's the founder and CEO of Biodiversify, which is a UK-based biodiversity consultancy. They've recently started a huge project with Suntory to do their nature strategy. And so Sam's going to be talking about that. So great to see a very high-profile Japanese company really going all in on nature and taking it seriously. So really looking forward to discussing with them what we're seeing sort of at a global level in terms of sustainability activities in the business world, what's happening in Japan, and you know where we see things going. Despite everything that's happening in the US, it's good to see that there are positive things happening elsewhere.
Absolutely. It's, you know, even though it's depressing and things are not going as well as, you know, we're losing momentum, but there's still so much opportunity. Yeah. And when we're moving forward with strategy that works and thinking about what we can do, that's really inspiring, right?
It is. And I'm hoping, you know, seeing companies like Suntory take the lead on things like this, I'm hoping that will inspire other Japanese companies also, or other companies based here, to say, oh, that's something we should be doing too, and get on board. So
absolutely.
It is encouraging.
Yes. And then you've got another event you were talking about, Anne Nahal.
So Anne Nahal is a small company based in Yokohama, and they do diversity and inclusion training. And every year they do the wonderful International Women's Day event. This was the third year, and that was also last week. And they had really great lineup of speakers from companies like Fujitsu, Panasonic, IKEA, and so on. And some really good panels sort of talking about maybe some of the challenges that are still in place. And it was interesting because I was sat next to the CEO of IKEA in the audience for one of the panels. And she was saying, really, you know, do we need to be still talking about gender equality in 2026? You know, coming from Sweden, she said, you know, sometimes she's amazed that we're still having this conversation. But then when we heard what the panelists were talking about and their experience here as female leaders, she's like, oh, okay, now I know why we still need to have the conversation. And actually, when it got to the Q&A, there was one lady who stood up to ask a question, and she was almost in tears. She could hardly speak to begin with. And we had to say, okay, just you know, take your time, it's all right. Because she was so emotional. She's like, it's, I faced so many challenges as a female in my career, as a, you know, trying to move up through the ranks. And it's so inspiring to hear that there are companies, Japanese companies as well, really trying to change things here. So it, there is still so much work to do, but it was very inspiring to see some great examples.
Absolutely. We also had Tomoko joining us from Facebook. Thanks so much for joining. And that is our time, Tova. 30 minutes goes so fast. Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thanks again for all the great things that you're doing, Tova, and all the great things on our radar. We're happy to share it with a wider audience and see you next month.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.